This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. Unfortunately, COVID strikes again. According to the news coming out of Jamaica, legendary reggae artist Frederick Nathaniel Hibbert died of complications due to COVID-19 on September the 11th. Later in the show, a tribute to the man universally known as Toots. First, my guest is Victoria Phillips. Her new book is called Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. Victoria Phillips, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to tell you right off the right at the top here, I'm a big lover of dance. I have been for since I was a teenager. And one of the big treasures for me in my life was going fairly often to see the Royal Ballet. And is anybody that hasn't been, I'm just going off on tangent before we get going. It's absolutely just glorious stuff. And I did happen to see the Martha Graham Dance Company one time when I was quite young, I should add. And that was a treat, a wonderful treat. Oh, okay, so let's get right into it. On your first page of the prologue, you write that Graham says, center stage is wherever I am. And I love that because it really sets the tone for this book. Can you talk about that and how that came about?
Well, you know, you really caught the essence of the book. And indeed, at one point, that was the title of the book, Center Stage is Wherever I Am, : Martha Graham and the Dance of American Diplomacy. And then we decided with the publisher that the book was a bit more than just Martha Graham, although she clearly is center stage during the entire book, because it's about her political life. And her life as a diplomat, which was something that was relatively unknown before this book was published. As a matter of fact, she said, my work is not political, very pointedly while on a State Department tour in India in 1955. So her denial of her political life really set her own stage that way. And indeed, for her to be apolitical was part of the political mission, as it were, as soft power.
Yes. And there's something else that you write, which I want to pick up on, and that's you say you intended to write about the relationship of American modern dance to communism during the interwar periods, but then the Graham Archives at the Library of Congress opened. Talk to me about that.
So I first found Martha Graham also as a teenager in New York City. And I saw her and her company on a Broadway stage, and she came on and she introduced her work, Diversion of Angels, which is about about love and the essence of love, the woman in red, yellow, and white, passion, joy, and purity. And I saw this and I saw her and I said, I want to do that when I was 16 years old. And because I went to a very progressive school, we can imagine the years now, I was allowed to leave school during the day and entered the Graham School and rose up fairly quickly through the ranks and made it to the professional company level class within about a year and a half while finishing high school. So I had a passion for Graham. There was a woman who had been with Graham, her name is Jane Dudley, and she actually started or really formed the London School of Contemporary Dance here in London. And she was an early Graham dancer and also a communist, which perhaps is one of the reasons that she left the United States. Her husband was blacklisted, a very famous documentary filmmaker. She has an FBI file herself. And I became extremely interested in communism and the American modern dance, and did I curated some exhibits, and that was where my first publications were, and then the Martha Graham archives opened. They were embroiled in a legal battle, and the Librarian of Congress sanctioned their opening. And because I had worked at the Library of Congress and searched for documents on communism and the American dance there and written the archivist a thank you note, she called me as soon as these precious archives were open and said, they are open and I'd like you to be the first person in to see them. So I went in, knowing and probably hearing Martha Graham say, my work is not political. And there were letters from George Kennan, the father known as the father of Cold War containment, Eleanor Dulles, the sister of the Secretary of State and head of the CIA, invitations from the Secretary of State to attend anti-communist meetings about how to destroy the Soviet problem in Asia. Henry Kissinger was involved. And I thought, well, wait a minute. This looks very political to me. And yes, that's where the adventure started.
Yes, yes. Thank you for explaining that. You paint the stories so incredibly well when the Graham Company arrives in Japan. Just the way you describe it is, I feel like I was there, the way you're talking about it. You've got wonderful quotes in this book from Graham. And there's another one. She says, I'm a thief. And then she adds, I only steal from the best. I love that. I'm just wonderful stuff. I want to ask you about, but as you were putting this book together, I was wondering if you were looking at any other books for reference, and I'm sure there was lots of different things. But did you look at the Rudolf Nureyev biography, which goes into great detail about his departure from the USSR? Did you look at that at the same time?
I had the privilege of looking at many different biographies and autobiographies, including Graham's own, and working through them to sift through various stories. And Nureyev indeed features in the Graham book,
yes,
as does Krishnikov. He was very generous and offered me an interview. And he also spoke about Nureyev and his relationship to Nureyev and how Nureyev brought him to Graham.
Yes.
So there was a very interesting political moment here with Nureyev and Baryshnikov. Both, you know, Baryshnikov also said, I didn't do anything political with Martha Graham. I just danced. But indeed, he was in something called American Document. And here is a Soviet man on stage reciting blurbs from the Declaration of Independence, yes, under George Bush. Yes. So it is absolutely fascinating that as a dancer, he didn't feel as though he were doing anything political. However, if you look at the, shall we say, the staging of it, it is quite political in the midst of the Cold War to have a Soviet dancer who is defected on stage reciting pieces of the of American founding fathers, and at the same time performing the distinctly American modern dance. So yes, this is what I try and draw into the book, which is what is the difference between Martha Graham making art and Martha Graham's art functioning as propaganda.
Yes. I love the way you wrap that together, because as I'm reading your book, it prompted me to go to my bookshelf and pull out the Nureyev biography, because I was looking at the differences between the two. What, she's going this way, he's going that way. It was such an interesting scene. It really is. And the stories that you write about Nureyev in your book. I want to ask you, Victoria, about the actual construction of your book, putting the book together, because there's a lot of references in here, and you did obviously have to read an awful lot of things, collate all the information together. So I'm wondering about the task, because it doesn't seem to me that it was a hard task in so much as you enjoyed it. Can you talk about that?
I love the chase. And I was recently asked by Biographers International, if you could do anything else, what would you be? And I do think I would like to be a murder detective in London.
Yes. Yes. You would make a good one. Yes.
So, you know, none of these archives, I really had to surround Martha Graham because she didn't want to be known as political. Many of these archives were difficult to find. And indeed, when I got to the National Archives in College Park, the U.S. National Archives, the State Department archivist said to me, oh no, Martha Graham never had anything to do with the State Department. So even the archivists didn't want this material necessarily to be found or didn't know it was there in some cases. For example, when I was working on Eleanor Dulles, the sister of John Foster and Allen, Dulles was known as the mother of Berlin and worked for the State Department in Berlin, and brought Martha Graham over for the opening of a building called Congress Hall, which is littered with celebrities, including Clare Booth Luce and other infamous women, Agnes DeMille and others. And in this process, I couldn't find any US documents except in the architect's files, which happened to be at Harvard. So I took a train to Harvard. I was raising three children, so I took the night train and slept on the train, arrived in the morning, home for dinner. And then as it turned out, it seemed that there were United States documents. And I thought, well, maybe they're in Berlin. So I flew to Berlin, and indeed in the Landesarchiv, which is the state, which holds the state papers for Germany, there were the US files.
You see, you would make a great detective writer or a murder mystery or something. Yes, you really would. I have to talk about something which is so important in your book, and so my listeners understand, and that is the collection of photographs that you've curated for the book. Can you just give a little overview of the photographs? Because you've got some wonderful things in here.
It was very difficult to decide which photographs to choose because, of course, it being dance and documented, it was just absolutely, you know, there's some marvelous pictures. Of course, there's also the question of copyright.
Yes, yeah.
Get permission for these pictures. And one of the things I learned was that because Martha Graham performed for every White House, Roosevelt through Bush,
yes,
not only would the Graham archives have these pictures, well, the presidents would also have these pictures. And if they are pictures taken by a presidential photographer, they are known as, they are owned by the government, hence a $17 fee for copyright. $300 or $400 for Getty Images or $600 or the like. So what that, just finding the pictures by going to the presidential libraries meant that I found an entire box and a new chapter, which put Betty Ford and Martha Graham together. Had a history of alcoholism and potentially abuse of narcotics. And they were fast friends, and there's some wonderful stories of the two of them with Halston at Studio 54.
Yes.
You know, with Nureyev and Baryshnikov. So oddly, the search for the photographs led me not only to Betty Ford, but also to Barbara Bush. That was an unknown part of the tour. And the way I found the Bush file on Martha Graham was by stumbling across a picture of Barbara and Martha playing with the Bush puppies.
Ah, yes. The photographs, everybody, when you get this book, you're just going to be enchanted by the photographs. And thank you for explaining that. Victoria Phillips is my guest. Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy is Victoria's brand new book. It's a big book, it's a hefty book, and it's a fascinating book. There's lots and lots of quotes, as I said just a little earlier. Graham declared, you write, that she could cross borders with dance. And she said, it is the first language. You touched on something that I want to get to, and that is her ability to sort of to get to know people and merge with people. So this really helped as a diplomat. But it also helped because she understood trends. You write that she understood trends, and this vis-a-vis the Studio 54 days. Can you give a little bit more about that?
This was one of my favorite chapters. Goes back to one of the quotes that you referenced and builds into this, which is the idea that she was a thief, but she only stole from the best, yes?
Yes.
So the Jimmy Carter Goodwill Tour of 78-79 was in response to the Camp David Accords. And of course, that was when the United States brokered the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt, with Jordan kind of hanging about in the wings. And shortly thereafter, Martha Graham went to Israel, Egypt, and Amman with dancers from Lebanon, which at that point was war-torn with its own civil war, imported into Amman to learn the dance and then take it back home. And this is the idea of taking what is billed as a distinctly American language of dance, free, universal, and that would could then be taken back to the various countries. Well, when Martha Graham was in Israel, she performed Judith, which of course is the story of the heroine who defeats the invaders and saves the Jewish people. When she goes to Egypt, she has tied herself into what was then called Egypt Mania, and the King Tut exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum, and the unfortunately named Sackler Wing, which held the Temple of Dendur. And she performed the tale of Cleopatra in Egypt. Now, you would think this is terrible cultural appropriation to be kind of doing the Egyptian in Egypt. And of course, what is so shocking in retrospect is that the Egyptians seemed to have mostly written that this was an appreciation of their culture, that it was the modernization of their 5,000 year history, and loved it. Then Appalachian, and of course in Israel, Judith was a huge hit. Appalachian Spring, which is this tale of the frontier and really quite politically inappropriate right now, Manifest Destiny and the conquering of an open frontier, which of course we all know didn't exist. And I thought, well, how did that go over? And I was in Lebanon interviewing one of the Lebanese dancers about her experience in Jordan. And she said, this was a great story for the Lebanese because it told the story of how a nation repaired itself after the civil war and came together as one, just as we want to. So at times I had to shut my mouth and just listen,
yes,
to appreciate some of these historical moments and what they felt was its grandeur, even if my brain wanted to say, well, wait a minute, that's not politically appropriate, is it? So there was this, Graham had this ability to grab onto the moment. I've always thought that often people ask, what would she have done in the Trump administration?
yes.
How would she have done a tour were she alive? And indeed, she did not accept the Medal of Freedom from Nixon. She had great reservations about Agnew and claimed never to have worked with Nixon. Well, indeed, she went on a multi-nation huge tour of Asia and the Middle East 6 weeks after Nixon resigned. There is no way that anyone can plan one of these tours in 6 weeks.
Right.
Ford gave it the sign off because she had studied under Graham, the first lady needing her own platform. It worked perfectly for Betty. And indeed, what I found was the through line was Kissinger. So Graham had worked with Kissinger under Nixon and then continued that work under Ford. And my thinking is that in this administration, if she wanted to get her company out to proclaim American values, she would have looked to Fiona Hill.
Yes, good one. I like that. Yes.
had this ability to attach herself to these wonderfully powerful women who had high ideals.
Yes. So which leads me to ask you, it seems to me from what you've written that these women, as you say, these women with high ideals also revered Martha Graham. Am I right in thinking that?
There was a whole litany of women who deeply admired Graham. Bezabeda Rothschild funded many, many tours and events. As I've said, Betty Ford, Eleanor Roosevelt was the first woman in the White House to bring Martha Graham to perform there in 1937. Jackie Kennedy Onassis was a huge champion of Graham in the White House and then on her board at galas, and she became Graham's editor at Doubleday for her autobiography. So literally through Graham's death, Jackie Onassis was by Graham's side. Barbara Bush also seemed quite enamored. Betty Ford, as I've said. On the other hand, Nancy Reagan did not seem as tickled by Graham.
Ah, yes.
Graham and Ronnie exchanged all sorts of notes, bless you, Martha, bless you, Ronnie. So she seemed to be able to sidle up to both men and women.
Yes. Yes, she had the best way to say it is a kind of seductive manner about her when she wanted to. On the other hand, and I need to get into this, she had a bad temper.
There's a wonderful story of was at a cocktail party with Anthony Tudor, the great English choreographer, and he said something and she swiftly kicked him. So indeed, she did have a very swift temper. But this is also what made her a great diplomat. She had, if we can imagine, a woman in the 1930s through 90s, managing dancers, stagehands, musicians, composers, this huge, 25, 30 people on these large tours, two planes, and in these very sensitive diplomatic situations oftentimes. They had to deal with men who were homosexuals, women who wanted to wear short skirts, and Graham ruled with an iron hand. And even in the late 70s, a dancer recalled that Martha saw her in a hotel elevator wearing blue jeans and just looked at her, and the dancer knew never to do it again. The women were expected to be in skirts. In the early years, through the 60s, white gloves, men in ties. So she kept strict order, which is interesting because the genre is freed.
Free, yeah.
Yet she also showed this highly disciplined company as a part of her legacy.
Victoria, this is, a difficult question, and that is, did you like Martha Graham?
That is just a wonderful question, Norman. And I did go through many, many iterations of that. I admired her to a scale which I can't even explain or bring to bear to this. She was a genius. That being said, she had some terrible issues. She was an alcoholic and treated people very poorly. She nearly killed herself. And I had to rewrite the book because at points I was so upset with my character for destroying her career, for destroying her body that she said was her temple with alcoholism. And I had to do a lot of work on alcoholism and to come to the understanding that this was a disease that she then conquered, which was, quite wonderful. In itself as kind of a phoenix-like story. I had my battles with her, which I suppose is what makes her such a great figure. I had the opportunity to get to know many of her dancers, some of whom had a large falling out with her. Mary Hinkson was one of them. Mary Hinkson was the first, along with Matt Tierney, the first African-American to be taken into a touring modern dance troupe in the United States. And indeed, this was in 1951, when Jim Crow laws were very much in force. And in order to bring Mary into the company and support her, Graham stopped touring the Jim Crow South. She didn't take many jobs. She had taken Yuriko from an internment camp in 1941, so was touring the United States during World War II. She was States during World War II with a Japanese star, which some people would have found difficult, given the fact that the president had interned Japanese. She, when there was extreme anti-Semitism in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, she had many Jewish dancers and refused to perform in Germany because after she had been invited by Goebbels because her company was Jewish. So she had this very strong belief in people and in civil rights and in the power of women to represent what is now, you know, kind of universal human truths. In other words, if you were a mythic figure experiencing jealousy, it could be just as well told by Ethel Winter, who was a Protestant, Mary Hinkson with a slave and a slave master great grandparents, to a Jewish woman. So she had this inclusive sense, yet she had these horrible fallings out with most of these women at the end.
Yes. You tell wonderful stories. And I think this is in the beginning of your book, if I remember correctly, when they go, the first tour, they go to Japan. And you describe how she made everybody dress in a certain way, the young ladies and the men wearing ties and the girls. But you also say how the makeup of the dance company, it was a big company. And it was shocking to other people looking on, particularly to the Japanese, of course, and to the Russians. There's something that you write, and this is not exactly what you wrote, but I'm just going to quote as I remember it. In 1932, returning from the Workers' Cultural Federation in Moscow, she says, "Art is a weapon." And then when they get back to New York, it became, "Dance is a weapon." So this leads me now to ask you about Martha Graham's non-political, yet she was political, her everyday life, talking to the company, to the staff on tour. Did politics come up, and how did she handle that?
You know, it's fascinating. I don't think politics ever came up, which is why modern dance is so perfect for soft power and political agendas, because it brings messages: freedom, democracy, equality, gender equality, racial equality, freedom of religion, all this idea of tapping into the hearts and minds of mankind with works like Diversion of Angels or Lamentation. So there's this idea that this is all apolitical because it is human, right? And then you layer onto this, of course, the Americana. So the Appalachian Spring, yes, the frontier. So most of these seasons, particularly early on, closed with Appalachian Spring, kind of like, you know, the American exclamation point at the end of the evening. But when it came to actual politics, there was one dancer who described how they were on tour during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And no one said a word. She said, "We were just too busy dancing."
Yes. Isn't that true, though, with dance and dance companies anyway, that it's such a preoccupation, in my experience of being around dancers, is that nothing else really matters apart from dance for most of the time?
That's right. And that's where, you know, Graham had this ability to tap into this idea of that moment of inspiration, of being there. But she was also quite aware that she had to keep a company going, that she had to keep the economics of it going, that she had to keep herself center stage with Broadway seasons and the like. So in that, Graham was both a, you know, was a dancer, a choreographer, a promoter, you know, a writer. She was really quite something and quite remarkable that way.
There's a word I've got to pick up on. I love this. Let me remind my listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Victoria Phillips. Her book is Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. There's a word you just said, and that's economics. Martha was, she was very good with getting money and handling money, it seems. Can you talk about that?
She was... One of the arguments that runs through the book is that without the Cold War, and without the need for the United States to promote itself on the global stage as sophisticated, modern, and not just, as the Soviets said, a bastion of hot dogs in Hollywood, the United States State Department funded American Ballet Theater's tours, Graham, the Graham Company, the Jose Limon Company, Alvin Ailey, theater companies, jazz, orchestras. And one of the claims that's been made by scholars is that really without the Cold War, this funding might not have come through. And my much smaller argument is that without these State Department tours, as far as I can read the numbers, American Ballet Theater, certainly Alvin Ailey, and probably the Martha Graham Dance Company would be bankrupt. Mm. Would have been bankrupt. So Alvin Ailey was scooped up out of bankruptcy because the State Department needed the company to go on tour and represent the United States because of these issues of racism. And Alvin Ailey was an amazing choreographer and a terrific diplomat as well. And his company, obviously, extremely talented. So the economics of this are very much tied to the Cold War. And of course, throws into question with the end of the Cold War, what has happened to government funding for the arts and government support in the United States versus the European counterparts.
Victoria, with your book, with the publication of Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy, do you think in this country, Martha Graham is going to be considered differently now, from now on, now you've written this book? And I say this country because I think Martha Graham is seeing, in my understanding, is probably appreciated more in a lot of respects overseas than she is in the United States.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, I always believe that Martha Graham should hold center stage. And I think that she not only should be recognized as a powerful choreographer, company manager in her own right, but also as an ambassadress during the Cold War. I mean, she really did bring people together. A wonderful story. I was giving a talk on this at the Museum of Diplomacy in Washington just before COVID struck. And a diplomat who introduced himself from Burma, which is now Myanmar, not as particularly friendly to the United States, came to the presentation just this year and came up to me and said, "Our country remembers Martha Graham so fondly, and I wanted to come hear your talk." Now, this is the kind of diplomacy you can't buy.
Yes.
Yeah, so this, and she hasn't been to Burma, Myanmar since the Ford administration. So there's a wonderful pull through of this kind of diplomacy that has long memory, solid memory. So I think she needs to be remembered that way as well. And in order to promote the power of soft diplomacy, of cultural diplomacy, of these kinds of efforts, where the results really can't be measured for generations.
Yes. Something else you touched on, and I'm curious about, and that is, if she was around today in the time of our current president, I'm going to throw it back to you and just open that up just a little bit, because she was such, she was center stage. She was such an important figure in the arts. I'm wondering right now, and this is just using imagination, of course, I'm just wondering right now, with how things are politically in this country, how Martha Graham would react. What would her be her stand, or what would she, where would she go? What would she do?
You know, I can imagine that the private and the public might be two very different personas.
Yes, yes.
She believed one of the great triumphs of her life was seeing the Berlin Wall come down. She believed in walls coming down and abhorred walls going up. So she was a true humanist that way. And I can't imagine that the idea of erecting a wall using government funds would be something that she would be in favor of. I think ideals such as truth and integrity were maxims for her. The body never lies, she said. She believed that she could see the truth of someone from the way they walked across the room. Sometimes in dance classes, she would just have us walk across the dance floor just to see what we had to bring to the floor, and just in our walk. So this kind of belief in human truth, I think she would foreground in any kind of talks that she gave in response to our current government. That being said, if the company needed funding, and as we saw with Nixon, you know, she held to her ideals when she hired Mary Hinkson, when she hired Yuriko, when she created the United Nations of Dance. On the other hand, she always had benefactors in her back pocket who could fund these things.
Yes.
So I think that but she would certainly make sure that she was not going bankrupt.
Right. Yes. Victoria Phillips has been my guest. The book is called Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. One last question for you, Victoria. Was she a great, she was a great dancer, I know that, but how great a dancer was she? I've been curious about this from the beginning of the book to the end of it. I kept thinking to myself, how great a dancer was Martha Graham? Or was she a great choreographer or a company manager? What was her greatest achievement in that respect?
It's such an interesting question. So by the time this book opens, it's 1955, and she was born in 1894. And this is one of the tremendous paradoxes of this book, that she's on stage, close to 60, portraying the bride on the American frontier. So, you know, just as these State Department tours were taking off, her life as a dancer was really ending. There is no doubt that she was a beautiful dancer, but what this woman had was charisma. So when she took the stage and could barely walk, when I saw her in the 1970s and 80s, your eye just went to her. She was magnet. I recall that when you walked into the Graham School, when she was there, you'd put your hand on the doorknob and you'd know it. You'd walk into the school and there was like almost like a vibration. When she taught class, when she looked at you and gave you a comment, there was nothing like it. So I think it is her, you know, it's like some people have it and some people don't, right?
Yes. Thank you for that. That's a great explanation. You know, as you're saying that, you're making me think of every dancer I've ever known. And you probably know this, every dancer has the dancer's walk, don't they? They have that. It's for those many years of practicing, you can't help it. Feet outwards, it's a lovely walk, I always think. It's so recognizable.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she had an unbelievable presence that made you stop.
Yes. You enjoyed writing this book, didn't you?
I did. I enjoyed it a great deal. I'm looking forward. I'm now starting work on my next project, which is a biography of Eleanor Dulles, who I met in chapter 3 of this book, and is a wonderful diplomat in her own right, with stories of Berlin and Cold War tunnels being dug and kidnapping.
Yes.
And things like that.
Well, I wish you success with that, and I wish you all success with this wonderful book. My guest, Victoria Phillips, her book is called Martha Graham's Cold War, The Dance of American Diplomacy. It is a tremendous book. It really is a wonderful read. Victoria Phillips, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Norman, thank you so much.
Details about Victoria Phillips' book are up at lifeelsewhere.co. Now make sure you go there to subscribe and find out all about our affiliate stations and podcasts. Coming up, a tribute to a legend, the man known as Toots, right after this.
This is Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. We would like to know what you think of our program. Send your comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Sign for what's been.
The distinctive voice of Toots Hibbert. This is a live recording from 1964, the Maytals, at the Sombrero Club in Jamaica. Sadly, the news came in as we were producing this edition of Life Elsewhere that Toots Hibbert had died of complications due to COVID-19 at University Hospital, Kingston, Jamaica. That was on September the 11th. The reggae legend is widely credited as the genesis of the genre name reggae after his 1968 song Do the Reggae, spelled R-E-G-G-A-Y. He was the youngest of 8 children. He became an orphan at the age of 11, and in 1962, while working at a local barber shop, he heard singing by Ralphus Raleigh Gordon and Nathaniel Jerry Mathias. They called themselves the Maytals. In 1962, the trio were discovered by producer Clement Coxone Dodd, who signed them to his Studio One label. Hibbert's soulful lead vocals were often compared to US soul icons Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett. The Maytals hit a serious roadblock in 1966 when Hibbert was arrested for possession of marijuana. He was convicted and served a year behind bars. This experience provided the inspiration for one of his best-known songs, 5446, That's My Number.
Sing it up, mister! Hear what I say, sir, yeah. No, yeah. Get your hands in the air, sir! Woo, yeah. Then you will get no hurt, mister, no. I said yeah,
I said yeah.
Hibbert's stay in prison coincided with ska fading from the musical landscape in Jamaica as the proto-reggae sounds of rocksteady took its place. The new style suited Toots and the Maytals, and they signed with producer Leslie Kong, with whom the band would record some of their biggest hits, including Sweet and Dandy, Monkey Man, and Pressure Drop.
Yeah.
Island Records mastermind Chris Blackwell next signed Toots and the Maytals, releasing a revamped version of the album Funky Kingston. By the end of the 90s, Hibbert had assembled a new version of Toots and the Maytals without Gordon and Mathias, and toured extensively while recording a handful of albums for various reggae specialist labels. Toots went on to collaborations with Eric Clapton, Willie Nelson, Bonnie Raitt, Keith Richards, and more. And then, after a 2013 incident in which he was hurt by a vodka bottle thrown by an intoxicated fan, he eats back on his career, performing occasionally but staying away from the studio. 77-year-old Toots Hibbert passed away, but he will long be remembered as one of popular music's most important contributors.
Yes, sir. One, two. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. Let me know what you think of Life Elsewhere. My email address comes up in just a moment. Over on Life Elsewhere Music, make sure you check out our Jukebox Jury. Till next time, be well, be safe, and always, it costs nothing, be nice.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.